Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Dramatic reversals today from two Republican lawmakers on health care reform mean that the party's health care bill might come up for a vote this week and pass after all. Michigan Republican Fred Upton and Missouri Republican Billy Long emerged from a meeting with President Trump at the White House this morning to say they are back on board with GOP health care reform. Sarah Cliff is a senior editor at Vox covering health policy and joins us now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
So is this going to happen now?
That is the million or billion dollar question here in D.C. today. It really has been quite a roller coaster ride, as you mentioned, with representatives getting off board with the bill, getting back on board. Right now, we really see the White House and Republican leadership in Congress in deal-making mode. They want to do what it takes to kind of get the caucus together and on board behind this bill. And they're getting closer, but they don't seem to be quite there. We have not had a vote scheduled quite yet.
Well, what caused these members to switch today?
Yeah, so these members were two members who were concerned about people with pre-existing conditions who might not be able to get coverage under the Republican plan. And what got them on board was some additional money to fund high-risk pools. These would be a way to cover the costs of expensive patients by pulling them out of the individual market, putting them into a government-run set of a pool for people who have really costly conditions. You know, some experts say $8 billion over 5 years, it's not a lot of money. It actually doesn't move the ball very much when you're talking about a lot of people with expensive healthcare conditions. But at least for these legislators, it was enough to get them to yes and get them back on board with the Republican plan.
And this gets to that issue that we've been talking about for days now about how pre-existing conditions are covered under this Republican plan. So where are we on that question?
Yeah, so that's something that changed a lot last week with this amendment to the Republican plan that would essentially allow states to waive out of Obamacare's requirement that they always charge sick and healthy people the same premiums. That is something that worried Republican legislators. It's something that the Freedom Caucus, the real right wing of the House Republicans, wanted. It was a non-negotiable for them. But then you see some of the moderates saying, hey, we don't actually want to take it that far. And the compromise that they're trying to work out now is saying, yes, we're going to keep that language in. We are going to allow states the option to sometimes charge sick people higher premiums, but we're going to put more money towards high-risk pools, essentially a place to catch those people who might be priced out of the individual market.
And there are questions about how well those high-risk pools actually work. But if this bill were to pass through the House, does it have any chance in the Senate?
It has an uphill battle in the Senate, I would say. You know, you have a lot of senators who've already expressed a lot of negative opinions about the House bill. There are things they want to change. I think senators are quite concerned about the cuts to Medicaid. The Republican bill, as it stands, would cut $880 billion for Medicaid. A lot of these senators come from states that have expanded Medicaid, and they are nervous about that. So I think getting through the House would be a very significant step for Republicans, but it's only the first step, and they're sending it to another chamber that has already expressed a lot of reservations about moving this bill forward.
If this bill were to pass, how many people would lose their health insurance or face higher premiums, or do we know?
So we don't quite know yet. One of the odd things that's happened here as Republicans are rushing towards this vote is they have not gotten a score on this legislation from the Congressional Budget Office, which is the kind of nonpartisan scorekeeper here in Washington. It is generally traditional and expected that before you pass any big legislation, you get a CBO score to know how many people might lose coverage, what the cost of their overall package might be. We do have a CBO score from the last iteration of the Republican bill. That one estimates that 24 million Americans would lose their insurance coverage under the Republican plan. But right now, Republicans don't seem very concerned with getting a CBO score. They seem much more concerned with just moving this through the House and that, you know, they want to keep this momentum and don't want to see anything slowing them down.
Just real quick, we've just got a few seconds left. But yesterday, Budget Director Mick Mulvaney created some confusion over whether funding for Obamacare subsidies will be in the temporary spending bill that has to pass this week. What's the latest there?
Yeah, so it looks like it will not be in the temporary spending bill, and this creates more uncertainty around the Affordable Care Act. The Trump administration has been very coy about whether they'll make those payments, and that's yet another hurdle for the healthcare law, which is still really trying to attract insurance companies to stay in the program.
That's Sarah Cliff, senior editor at Vox. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
Now to Canada, where climate change is warming the northern region of our neighbor 4 to 5 times faster than the global average. That's wreaking havoc on the frozen roads made of ice that provide access to remote towns in Canada's Northwest Territories. Lately, those ice roads have been freezing over later and melting earlier, creating dangerous conditions for drivers and cutting off some towns from supply routes. Joining us now from Yellowknife, the capital of the Northwest Territories, is Wally Schumann, the province's minister of infrastructure. So, Minister Schumann, tell us about these ice roads. They're, for instance, frozen lakes?
There's frozen lake ice. Some of them are over a combination of land and ice, river crossings. So we have a number of different type of terrain that they're on.
I have been on them, and I have to tell you, I was frightened the whole time, even though when we say it's frozen ice, it is several feet deep.
Well, the lakes and rivers could be, hundreds of feet deep.
Yeah.
Generally, to get a heavy truck on it to haul a load of diesel fuel or propane and that sort of thing, that's normally up to at least 4 feet thick.
Yeah. So they're nice and thick, and they can take these, normally trucks with supplies. Tell me about the Tolicho Winter Road. It connects some remote communities to you in the city of Yellowknife there.
Okay. The ice road in the Tolicho region services 3 communities. It actually comes out of one of the bigger Tolicho communities, Betroco. It goes north from there and services the community of Wati, Gamati, and Wekawenti. These are predominantly Aboriginal communities that have been there for generations. Like I say, Wati is probably the bigger of the three. Well, it is for sure. There's probably several hundred, 500 to 600 people there. You get to Gamati, it's a bit smaller, and Wekawenti's has probably less than 200 people, and it's pretty much out in the tundra.
Yeah, bringing fuel that they need to run things, bringing food. And talk about the crews that have to sort of rebuild these roads every year.
So every one of these ice roads in the Northwest Territories, we got to wait till freeze up, of course. The first thing you need to do is profile how thick the ice is to get the early equipment on there. So in the old days, you'd either have to walk it and drill holes to do it. Way technology is now, you can profile it by dragging a machine behind a snowmobile, and even some of the fancier equipment, you can put it on a helicopter and fly the route to determine the thickness before we get on it. And then the crews get on there and clear the snow away to open up the ice to the air, because snow acts as an insulator and would makes it longer how long it takes to build up the thickness of it. So we got to get the equipment on there, clear the snow off, and then you start building ice. And that's the challenges now with climate change. In the old days, you probably didn't have to build up ice thickness, but being that we're warming faster than anywhere else in the world, sometimes we're going to have to drill and water all these crossings and to bring up the ice.
I was reading about that. You drill down and then with a hose shoot up some of the water and so that it can freeze on top. It's amazing. And you have radar that could, look through and tell you how thick the ice is. Some would say, well, why not, build roads? I'm imagining that's prohibitive. Roads or bridges be unbelievably expensive. So what's going to happen to this, Canada's First Nations peoples who are being cut off when these roads thaw too soon or are closed? We know some of the people up in that area are upset with how the government is closing roads. These are supply roads. So what's going to happen?
Well, that's the challenge as a government. We have to try to open them as soon as we can, but we can't open them unless they're safe. And the challenge in this time of year, we've had a number of calls even closing down roads because they look like they're safe to travel on, but with the warming temperature and the water running underneath there, it's cutting away at the ice surface. So you could physically look at it, and it looked like you could drive on it. But the challenge of having a loaded heavy rig on there right now is the chance of falling through is a safety issue, and we have to end up closing some of these earlier.
Yeah. I read an anecdotal story about a guy who parked his truck on the ice overnight. He came out. It was gone. You don't want that. Look, you're it would seem, as the Minister of Infrastructure, are sort of on the front line of climate change. What else are you thinking you might have to address as we go forward?
Well, we have the challenges around the ice roads, but we have a number of all-season roads that are affected by the climate change right now. We have permafrost degradation on a number of our roads, and that's costing us millions of dollars to repair and maintain the existing infrastructure that we got.
Because they buckle and everything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So actually, the road that you just particularly asked me about out at where it starts at Vetrico between here and Yellowknife is probably one of the roughest sections we have in the Northwest Territories from heaving.
Mm. From heaving. Well, we wish you well there. Are there people who are in danger right now of being stranded? And we, you know, what will you do? Will you helicopter supplies in? Or?
Well, we have a number of communities that are, most of them are serviced by ice roads, but we have a number of up in the far north that are only serviceable by sea or air, and we will continue to do that. The challenge moving forward to the ones that are on the ice road system is to try to get them up and running sooner and as safe as possible and try to keep it open as long as we can, but we can't control Mother Nature, so that's going to be the challenge moving forward.
Yeah. That's Wally Schumann, Minister of Infrastructure for Canada's Northwest Territories, where the ice roads are melting sooner than ever because of climate change. Minister Schumann, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
On Sunday, French voters will choose their next president, and the result could have big implications for the future of Europe. The far-right candidate Marine Le Pen wants to take France out of the European Union. Her opponent, the centrist Emmanuel Macron, says he's pro-Europe, but he has also said the EU needs to be reformed to prevent a Frexit, a French exit from the EU. Joining us now from Brussels via Skype is Tom Natal, a columnist for The Economist. Tom, welcome.
Hi there.
And I want to start with Marine Le Pen. Our NPR correspondent in Paris, Eleanor Beardsley, spoke with Jean-Marc Ilouz, who's a former political correspondent for France 2 television, about Sunday's election. And here's what he said.
I do think that Marine Le Pen can win because she's such a great speaker, because she is so able to use passion.
Now, that kind of goes against the grain of what we have been hearing, which is that it's going to be very difficult for her to win. What do you think?
Well, frankly, I think he's wrong. I don't think she can win. The opinion polls have been very consistent, including since the first round a week and a half ago. There's barely been an opinion poll that has Emmanuel Macron, who is challenging Marine Le Pen in the runoff on Sunday, with a gap of less than 20 percentage points over her. To put it very simply, if she were to win on Sunday, it would be the biggest opinion poll failure of all time.
But I feel like we've seen a few of those in recent years, some pretty big opinion poll failures.
Yeah, but not of this magnitude. So this sort of narrative has emerged, particularly after the victory of Donald Trump and of the Brexit referendum in Britain last year, that the polls are way off. Actually, if you look at where the polls were, there may have been a bit of error, but both of those results were very close. And of course, in the American case, Hillary Clinton actually won the popular vote.
Right.
They weren't polling disasters. This would be an order of magnitude different, a failure of this sort. And it's also worth noting, by the way, that in the first round of the French presidential election, the polls were extremely accurate.
All right. Well, let's just do the thing that would be responsible for us to be doing as journalists, which is let's play out the scenario. If Le Pen does win, what happens to Europe?
Oof. Well, ask a lot of people here in Brussels and they'll say that's game over. That's the end of the EU. And the reason that they say that is that this place, really ever since it was founded as a club of six countries in the 1950s, has always relied on what is sometimes called the Franco-German motor, a sort of concord between France and Germany to provide the political and the economic energy to keep the show on the road. Now, obviously, this is now a club of 28 or 27 when Britain leaves. But that idea is still at the heart of it, that nothing substantial can happen in the European Union if France and Germany aren't working together. With Marine Le Pen as president, someone who has hinted very strongly that she would like to see France leave the European Union, that she thinks that European Union is a sort of a club of has-been globalists that has nothing to say to ordinary people, then that idea is blown out of the window. Now, you probably don't see the end of the European Union, but you see a very, very different sort of club, one where the bonds between countries are much weaker than they were, which doesn't have the same sort of pursue the same ideas of integration that it has for decades in the past. And the biggest question mark will be over the future of the euro, the single currency shared by 19 of the countries inside the European Union. France, of course, is a member of that. Marine Le Pen has sort of hemmed and hawed on her policy on the euro. But if a question mark were put over France's membership of the euro, then a question mark would be put over the survival of the currency overall, and that would be a big danger.
Would the danger come back up again if Le Pen loses? Is there another country? We're having elections soon in Germany. Is there another country that could cause the same kind of havoc for the EU?
Not Germany. As you say, we've got elections there later this year. But it's not clear who will end up as chancellor, but it will easily be Angela Merkel, who's been running the show for over a decade. It will be her social democratic challenger, Martin Schulz, who, as a former president of the European Parliament, does not have pro-European credentials that anyone could question. I think the country to watch is Italy. Now, Italy isn't due to hold elections until next spring. Although you never know with this country, its politics are always very unstable. The Italian economy has been performing disastrously badly for a long time. There's been very little growth. Productivity performance has been appalling. And for that reason, you've seen a big growth in support for parties like the Five Star Movement and some other anti-European parties. If a coalition of these parties were to come to power after an election next spring, then I think you'd see markets go haywire. You'd see big question marks over Italy's future inside the Eurozone. And I think that is probably what worries people more than what's going to happen in France, or certainly what's going to happen in Germany.
That's Tom Natal, a columnist for The Economist, speaking with us from Brussels. Tom, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, now to a very different race.
Up to the finishing line. Time, 3 minutes, 59.4 seconds, shattering the 4-minute mile, the Everest of athletic achievement.
In 1954, Roger Bannister became the first person to run the mile in under 4 minutes. Well, this Saturday, three runners will try to break another barrier, running a marathon, 26.2 miles, in under 2 hours, in a special race in Italy. The three elite runners are Zersane Tedese of Eritrea, Lalisa Dasitsa of Ethiopia, and Kenyan Eliud Kipchoge. And right now, the fastest ever marathon is 2 hours, 2 minutes, 57 seconds. And you might be saying, if a man, and we're talking about men here, could run under 2 hours, wouldn't he in the marathons we follow? Well, maybe not. Ed Caesar is the author of 2 Hours, The Quest to Run the Impossible Marathon. He's covering Saturday's race for Wired. There's a hint there. But Ed, talk about why maybe this can't be done in a regular marathon.
I mean, one reason why they may not be able to do it is it may really be beyond the bounds of human physiology to do it.
Right.
But let's say, for instance, that it is possible, and lots of scientists seem to think it is possible physiologically. The things that slow you down in marathons are things like corners, the wrong temperature. Getting into a race, oddly, can often slow you down because your pace is uneven throughout the marathon. And big city marathons are wonderful and joyous events, but they're not always set up in the way that you would set up a marathon if you were just interested in how fast the very top guys could go.
Nike is behind the project. It's called Breaking 2. And it's interesting. They started this project, you found out, a year before you wrote your book about breaking this two-hour mark. So tell us, first of all, how this race is set up.
They're going to run it around a car racing track at Monza, where they race Formula One cars normally. And they're going to go 17 and a half laps around the junior track at Monza. It might sound a little boring to you, but I think it's going to actually be very cool to watch because you're going to see the athletes coming round pretty regularly, whereas in a marathon, you only get to catch them maybe once or twice if you're lucky on the course.
Right. They're going to be protected from wind and elements. They're going to have a lower temperature, so it's cold, so that they don't overheat. Pacemakers might come in and out to pace them, not compete with them, which will change the nature of their running. And we understand that they have been tested, prodded, that Nike has been working on coming up with special, you know, aerodynamic clothing and shoes. I think, do you have the shoes?
I do have the shoes, and they are fairly extraordinary. I have no, I'm not a spokesman for Nike, but, you know, I ran in them a couple of times now, and I'm going to run in them again this weekend. And they do promote a very unusual feeling in a runner. You feel like you're being propelled forward, and that's because of the angles of where your foot sits in the shoe. And you really do whiz along.
Well, you had some questions about the race going into Saturday. It's a big company. Of course, they want it to work. You want to make sure there's no doping going in. It feels like there's been a lot of scrutiny of this race. How are you feeling about it? How are you feeling about this, you know, over 2 minutes, 3 minutes being dropped from a world record in potentially in one shot?
I think it is an extraordinary thing to attempt. And there's a lot of risk in it for Nike. And I think they would be happy if someone got close to 2 hours. You'd learn a lot about what people can do under the right conditions. But what I really hope is not so much thoughts about shoes or about what you can do when you set up a marathon in the right way. I want them to understand just how special these athletes are, the human beings, complicated, you know, driven human beings who are trying to do this. You know, that will be a huge victory as far as I'm concerned, because the more you can humanize runners and tell their stories, I think the better the sport becomes.
Do you worry that this somehow takes away from what we know as the marathon, these races that happen around the world and people feel they're a part of it just by standing on the sidelines, and the drama, the stories, the narratives that unfold? You know, can they withstand the heat? Can they withstand that bump on the turn from another runner? Here's the great Australian marathoner Rob Di Castella with some thoughts on, you know, what is the romance of the marathon?
There's no such thing as world records in the marathon. The marathon is unpredictable, it's variable, it has a certain mystique and a romance about it that you can't put in a box and you can't write criteria for, you can't define, and that's the beauty of it.
Ed Caesar, this is something that they're trying to put in a box and they're trying to define. Do you worry about it taking away from what we know as the marathon?
I want the marathon to continue to be really unpredictable, to have great races. You know, I love the traditional marathon, and there's nothing stopping it from continuing. There is also nothing stopping us from doing events like this, one-offs, just to see what the body is capable of. And I think traditionalists have been dismayed by breaking two because they see it as a derogation of the sport. In fact, events like breaking two have always been a part of the sport, and I think they should be celebrated alongside traditional marathons.
Ed Caesar, covering the attempt to run a marathon in 2 hours or less for Wired. It's called the Breaking Two Initiative, scheduled for Saturday in Monza, Italy. Ed, thank you.
Thanks so much.
There's been terrible, tragic flooding in parts of the country. Two children swept from their mother's arms in Arkansas a few days ago. Yesterday, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo issued a state of emergency in response to flooding along the south shore of Lake Ontario, where the water is almost 2 feet higher than usual. The Great Lakes are so big that they can act just like an ocean, with punishing waves that erode the shore. Veronica Volk of Here Now contributor Great Lakes Today went to Port Bay in New York, where residents are scrambling to hold back that lake.
Port Bay is a quiet cove off Lake Ontario. Its shore is lined with little white cottages, interspersed with larger lake cabins and full-time residences. Janice Prosek lives right on the water, and at the edge of her property is a long floating dock, a little paddle boat, and a clear view across the bay. She just moved here full-time to get out of the city.
I stood in the middle of the yard, I looked around here, and I said, yep, this is home.
This is it.
This is home. This is it. I says, I don't even care what it looks like inside.
But now she's worried about her home. The only thing protecting the small bay from the powerful waves of the Great Lake is the Port Bay Barrier. It's a narrow strip of beach lined with a few trees and shrubs, and it's been eroding for years. Lindsay Gerstenschlager with Wayne County Soil and Water has been working on a plan to conserve the barrier, but she says conservation is a lot more complicated than it used to be.
Mother Nature's not giving us the chance to get caught up. She's constantly changing.
One suggestion has been to install some boulders or concrete along the shore, but that could cause more erosion in other places. Gerstenschlager also has a lot of variables to consider with climate change. Storms are worse and more frequent, and the lake hasn't frozen in recent winters, so there's no respite from the eroding power of waves and tides.
It's a little bit nerve-wracking. It's a new world. Trying to see what the new rules are.
Just a few days after we spoke, the lake flooded and ripped a 50-foot hole in the barrier, right on the spot where we'd been standing. Now, damaging waves and debris are rushing through the breach and clogging the bay. From the end of her dock, Prosek can see whitecaps crashing over the breach in the barrier. She points out some large logs and branches washing up against her property.
Bring some attention to this, because we really need help, and we need it fast.
Experts say this spring's floods are due to months of heavy snow and rain. But residents and some local officials blame the flooding and erosion on a new plan to regulate the lake's levels that went into effect this year. The plan lets the lake get more flooded before letting water out and artificially bringing the levels down. That, along with the breach, has residents like Prosek pushing for immediate action.
We don't have time to study and wonder and postulate and evaluate, and I think we need to start making some decisions and hope that they're the right ones.
other residents are still advocating for a long-term conservation plan.
There's an ecosystem that's there that has to be protected.
Dave Ulrich is with the Port Bay Improvement Association, which is also involved in the project.
There are people that want us to take our time and make sure it gets done right. And there are people that just want it solved right now.
The county originally expected to have a long-term conservation plan ready by fall, but is now considering faster action. Meanwhile, Lake Ontario is expected to continue rising over the next few weeks, which means more stress on the barrier and more risk that it won't be able to protect Port Bay. For Here and Now, I'm Veronica Volk in Port Bay, New York.
And Veronica's story comes to us from Great Lakes Today.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Dance, little DJ, come on.
Liza Richardson is a DJ at KCRW. She's also a film and TV music supervisor, helping to pick music for some of the shows and movies that we watch. She joins us from Santa Monica, California. Liza, welcome back.
How's it going, Jeremy?
It's going well, and you have brought us some music from all around the world. And let's get to the first one. This is the Cuban-Canadian artist Alex Cuba. This is called Yo Sé Quién Soy.
De oscuridad le pintaré al sol un acento. De claridad le haré al dolor un descubrimiento. Así llego a un acuerdo conmigo. Desde hoy. Yo sé quién soy.
What caught your attention about this?
So this album, it's called Lo Único Constante, is basically a tribute to a movement in Cuba in the 40s. It's called the Filin Movement.
The Filin Movement, which is what exactly?
So it's based on the English word feeling, and it's also called El Feeling Movement. Mm. And I just learned about it, actually, when I looked it up. But then I realized that a lot of the artists that were part of that movement, like Los Zafiros, are some of my favorite Cuban artists. And it's emotional. It's with a lot of feeling. It's a bit dramatic, but without superficiality, very honest.
All right, well, up next, you wanted us to hear the group SJOB Movement. This is Love Affair, the Soul Power All-Stars rework.
From the beginning of time, man was born free to live in love. How did it ever love to say? And you got to taste the taste of love. Didn't you see that love is the greatest thing in life?
So tell us what we're listening to here.
So this is a new remix. It's an old, old, rare, heavy funk song from 1977, Nigeria. The reissue is brand new, and it features all the old recordings. But this one particular track that we're listening to right now is a remix. It's called Love Affair by Soul Power All Stars. They do the rework, but the artist is SJOB Movement. The album is called Friendship Train, and that pretty much describes the path and the career of this band. They were just like a group of buddies that played together. They invited other buddies to join in. So SJOB were the initials of the original members, and then they all played in tons of other bands, including one went on to play drums with the King Sunny Ade band. And it was the first time they had electric drums in a juju band, which is traditionally only ethnic drums. But this kind of music became very popular in 70s Nigeria as people became less interested in traditional music and more interested in things like James Brown, Santana, Jimi Hendrix, that kind of thing.
And are these two things that we've heard so far pieces of music that you would put into a movie?
Well, if I had the opportunity, absolutely. I would definitely play these all on my radio show on KCRW. And I would love to find a spot for it because I'm playing you songs that I absolutely love. And, you know, I have a particular adoration for all things vintage African. So, you know, all the funk soul mm-hmm. and the heavy rock. Lagos was where it was happening. And I wish I could have been there. But yeah, if I could find... I work on a show called Narcos. We use all Colombian music for, you know, Narcos on yeah. Netflix. And it's great to just indulge in that kind of music. It would be so neat to do the same thing doing a show or a film that takes place in Lagos, Africa. I would... Nigeria. I would relish that opportunity, but I don't have that.
Well, at least not right now. Let's see.
Right.
But let's get to the next piece of music from you. This is L. Michael's Affair with Shaolin Brew. Now, this I could definitely imagine in a movie, probably right when they figure out how to rob the bank.
Right. It's got, definitely has that retro feeling, sort of a hazy sound,
right.
A unique fidelity, recorded analog. And yeah, it could be sort of blaxploitation type film, couldn't it?
Right. Well, tell us about it.
So, L. Michael's Affair is fronted by Leon Michaels, and he produces so many very cool throwback artists that we love these days, like Lee Fields. There's also a cool reggae retro band called The Shacks. Anyway, this is the guy behind the sound of a lot of those, kind of a Daptone sound, right? So on this new album, it's called The Return to the 37th Chamber. He interprets songs by Wu-Tang Clan. He did this before in 2009 with his album Enter, the 37th Chamber, and thus now The Return. So Shaolin Brew, which is the song that we're listening to, is Wu-Tang's contribution to the St. Ides hip-hop endorsement campaign from 1994. So it's like a song that wasn't on an album, but was in that campaign. So it's pretty cool.
All right, well, we have time for one more, and this is the British artist Mr. Jukes. It's called Angels/Your Love, featuring BJ the Chicago Kid. Oh, I really like this one.
I know. It's neat. It's different. I haven't really heard anything quite like this. You've got sort of a jazzy, funky thing happening. You've got a kids choir, which I love kids choirs. Mm. You have this giant sample, and apparently it's by Argentine jazz icon Jorge Lopez Ruiz. It's a free-flowing odyssey, heavy on saxophones with R&B vibes, and also features some soulful vocals from BJ the Chicago Kid. He's an excellent rapper.
And what should we know about Mr. Jukes?
Mr. Jukes is a.k.a. Jack Steadman. He is from the band The Bombay Bicycle Club.
Hmm.
And this is his new solo project. It's called God First.
Interesting side note. The Bombay Bicycle Club was the name of a mediocre Australian restaurant in my hometown in Illinois. I don't know if that's where the band name came from, but maybe.
Maybe. What town?
Champaign-Urbana.
All right. Okay. So. Very cool. I was born in Elgin.
Elgin. Oh, good. So a couple of Illinoisans here today.
Yes.
Liza Richardson, now a DJ at KCRW, also a film and TV music supervisor. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Jeremy. Appreciate it.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. That's NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
It used to be that only locals knew all the back road shortcuts to get around traffic. But now most of us have apps that calculate the fastest routes based on up-to-date traffic information. But what happens when everybody starts using the same previously secret shortcuts? Reporter Eli Wertschafter went to the city of Fremont, California, and found, well, traffic backs up there, too.
Rose Margaret Itua is an engineering professor at Ohlone College in Fremont. She says when she started teaching here 4 years ago, it took her only 25 minutes to get home.
But now, an hour to get home at best.
The slowest part of her drive is getting from her job to the highway. It's only a mile, a straight shot down a main road.
Sometimes when I'm really stuck in the traffic, I would use Google Maps. But then it would take me through another route that would just get me stuck in even worse traffic. So now I don't bother, I just stay here.
I want to test this out, so I pull out my phone and open the navigation app Waze. That's W-A-Z-E.
In 300 feet, turn right, then turn left.
We have about 2 blocks to go to get on the freeway, and it's telling us to make 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about 6 turns to get there.
Oh, not the best.
Itua isn't into it. And sure enough, we see that the traffic on the side streets is moving just as slowly as we are.
So if we followed Waze, we would be part of that now.
Now, you can't blame all the traffic on navigation apps. The economy here is growing. More people are commuting. But now, those commuters are piling up on local roads like never before.
So what we see happening in Fremont, we see happening in many other cities.
That's Alex Bayan, the director of the Institute of Transportation Studies at UC Berkeley.
It is definitely going to get worse as more and more people continue to use apps.
A spokesperson for Waze said that their app improves traffic by spreading it across the road system. But Bayan says while that might have been true when such apps first came out,
now a vast majority of people have smartphones, therefore have access to these apps, and now you see massive amounts of people who are changing their routing patterns based on better information.
So, Bayan says, traffic builds up on streets that weren't designed to handle it. That can slow down the whole system. Bayan says this effect relates to the theories of John Nash, the guy from the movie A Beautiful Mind. Nash demonstrated that what's best for individuals in a system isn't necessarily what's best for everybody. So, in this case,
routing people in the way that is best for them, the fastest way, doesn't mean that traffic overall is moving more efficiently.
In Fremont, the city is trying to deal with some of this app-induced traffic. Noe Veloso, a transportation engineer for the city, drives me out to a street that's gotten a lot of cut-through traffic.
I mean, we wanted to restrict this cut-through route 100%.
So Veloso and his team installed a sign. It says, no right turns from 3 to 7 p.m. But for the sign to do its job, the apps need to know about it too. So the city contacted Waze.
Waze had agreed to actually upload this and implement this onto their navigation application.
And Waze stopped directing drivers here. But the problem isn't just Waze. The most popular driving app, Google Maps, also sends drivers on alternate routes. And even though Google owns both Waze and Google Maps, Veloso learned the hard way that sending Waze information is not the same as sending it to Google Maps.
We actually, as a staff, kept putting in multiple notes to Google. We made this change onto our roadway system. Please update your system.
Google Maps eventually updated, but it took months. And at the time I was with Veloso, they were still sending drivers here. We watch as a few cars roll up and ignore the sign. They could be Google Maps users, or maybe they just know this shortcut and it's too hard to resist.
Yes, that's a black BMW Just made an illegal right turn.
Fremont recently joined a program where the city trades information with Waze. More than 70 agencies nationally have joined the program. Drivers find out when the city has closed a road or changed a sign. And in return, the city gets up-to-date anonymous traffic information. This program doesn't stop the traffic jams. But for now, at least it helps cities understand where they're coming from. For Here and Now, I'm Eli Wirtschafter.
And Eli's story comes to us from member station KALW in San Francisco.
Well, before we close out this hour, be careful where you play this song.
Welcome to the Hotel California.
The Eagles have filed a lawsuit against a hotel in Mexico called Todos Santos Hotel. The band says the hotel owners actively encourage guests to believe the hotel is associated with the band in order to sell merchandise, and that the hotel leads consumers to believe that the Todos Santos Hotel was the inspiration for the song. The hotel used to be called Hotel California, and it is apparently such a lovely place.
As Jeremy is the Hotel California in Santa Monica, but they don't pretend to be the real one. We told the Eagles' Timothy B. Schmidt when we stayed in that hotel, drunken people at 3 a.m. were belting out this song. He said, wouldn't be the first time.
I bet. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service and not in association with the Hotel California. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and GEICO, offering the GEICO mobile app. The GEICO mobile app stores ID cards, enables bill pay, and submits policy updates and claim reports directly from a user's cell phone. Learn more at GEICO.com.